From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Hi, and welcome to another John Hannam Meets. Today, we're going back to 2003, when I met Darren Nesbitt in Eastbourne.
Another Hannam Archive.
Darren Nesbitt, welcome to John Hannam Meets.
That's very nice of you, John. Nice to be here.
Now, when we met in Eastbourne, yes, in a sort of a coffee bar,
yeah,
and I came up to you.
Yes.
Did you think I was a crank or not?
No, I just thought you were going to ask for money. No, not at all. No, because often, you know, people come up and say, oh, excuse me, are you so-and-so? And, you know, you say, well, yes, you know, unless they think you're someone else. But then you say you are as well. So, you know, it was very pleasant, very nice.
Darren, and you're not dead either.
No, and I'm not dead. But you see, when you've been away to Australia for such a long time, so many years, 10 years, and when you come back, of course, people haven't seen your plays or anything like that. And so they do. They think that you are dead. We were doing this play in Mold, and two people came at the stage door and they said, Mr. Nesbitt, could we have your autograph because we thought you were dead?
Your dad was Harry Nesbitt,
yes,
a comedian.
Yes, Max and Harry Nesbitt.
Yeah. I know. Very famous act.
Very, very famous. And last week we were at the Liverpool Empire and I went to the opposite side, you know, the OP side. And that's where I used to stand as a little boy watching all the acts, you know, from 5 years onwards, really.
Did you like the days of variety? I'm sure you did.
I knew nothing else, you know. I never saw my father except on a Sunday because he was always, you know, working. And during the holidays, I went with him to, you know, all the cities and stood on the side of the stage and saw some amazing people. I mean, all the greats. So it was... But I, you know, this is normal. This was normal. I didn't know that anything was out of the ordinary in this.
I really just got into the dying days of variety, but
oh, yeah.
I loved it when you had 14 or 15 acts.
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. And it was so much noise and music and action and chorus girls.
Did you ever for one minute think of following Dad or not really?
No, not really, because I realised that it was dying and I never really fancied it. And, of course, my mother always said to me, well, of course, you'll never be as great as your father. So I thought following my father's footsteps probably is not the best idea.
Going to RADA was, yes, much more upmarket, wasn't it?
It was, yes. And it's very embarrassing because I left school at 14 because my father said we could bribe Dover College to get you in. I remember that. He said, I'm going round the world. What do you want to do? And seeing as he never spoke to me and seeing that this time was rather pleasant, I didn't take much time to say, I think I come with you. And we were on a boat going across the Indian Ocean. There was Lord and Lady Austin. I shall never forget this, of Austin cars. And she sort of befriended me, and I was very young. And she said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I want to be an actor. She said, oh, really? And I said, I want to go to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And she said, RADA. And I said, I'll try there as well. And even now I feel embarrassed by this.
You joined Peter Hall's Oxford company.
That's right. I left RADA and I was fortunate to win a lot of things, Shakespeare and the Kendall, which is the gold medal, you know. Mm. And Peter Hall chose me to go to Oxford to be in his company, which I did, straight from RADA, playing parts.
Wonderful. You did rep too in places like Eastbourne, where we are at this moment.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I remember it very well. One or two of these dressing rooms could tell a story or two.
And Worthing, where I think you just bought a house.
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, West Worthing. Yes. And of course, the Connaught. Yes, I was there when I was 21, playing A Love of Four Colonels. I remember that.
Were you?
Yeah.
You worked with Burton too at the Old Vic, didn't you?
Indeed, I did. And then much later in Where Eagles Dare.
I know,
yeah.
What was he like when you first met him?
Well, he was always drunk. He drank an enormous amount, even when he was at the Old Vic. And then later on in Where Eagles Dare, he was drinking 4 to 5 bottles of vodka a day. You know, it was really quite remarkable. You see this and you think, why? You know, it was, It was a way in a sad, because I mean, I'd seen a lot of acts in the musical be drunk and drink a hell of a lot, you know? So that didn't worry me so much, except the self-destruction of it, I thought, was depressing, you know?
He did well, but he should have done a lot better.
He could have done a great deal better, yes. But then again, you see, he was always interested primarily in the money. I'll tell you a story. I'm not sure if I should.
You can.
Well, my father always had Rolls Royces, which he couldn't drive, and so I did. And I was at the old Vic, so I used to drive the Rolls Royce there. And seeing I was on about £12 a week, I put it round the corner because it was a bit embarrassing. And I knew that Richard Burton was living in Haverstock Hill and we lived in Avenue Road. And his car broke down. Now, in those days, there were no black cabs. I mean, mini cabs. And the old Vic is right by the station. So no cab is going to stop because they all want to get into the station and get a big fare. So I said to him, I'll drive you home if you like. He said, well, you got a car? I said, well, no, not really. I said, it's my father's car, but, you know, he doesn't drive. He said, oh, that would be kind. So he said, where is it? I said, round the corner. He said, why don't you park? I said, well. So he walked round the corner and saw this vast Rolls Royce. He said, is this your car? I said, no, it's my father's car. I said, you know, they're very big stars since 1928. And he sat in the car, and I never forget this. We're driving, and he said, I can't afford one of these, you know. I said, oh, well, you know. He said, I've had this Shakespearean theatre business. He said, I'm sat there, and he looked up. He said, I'm going to earn money. He said, I'm going to earn real money. And that was at the old Vic. And that's really what drove him, you know, the need to have money far more than the acting, which is sad, really, you know.
In about 56, you started to do a bit of TV, like The Adventures of Sir Lancelot.
Oh, my goodness, yes. In fact, I was in every episode.
Were you?
Oh, yes, indeed, I was. And I got £25 a week and £7 if I was in an episode. And I remember I was in every one. And dear old Nigel Green was in every episode except one. And my first day's filming, I had to get into this armor. And I'm standing there in armor. I didn't know what was going on. They hand you a great big sword and an axe and a ball and chain and helmet. Helmet and armor, and he said to me, the director, charge through there. He said, fight the men at arms, run up the staircase. There's a man with a crossbow at the top. He'll fire the crossbow, duck. The arrow will go over you. There you'll see Lancelot. Go with him with the sword, sort of cut him with the sword, and he'll knock the sword out of your hand. Then he'll hit you, and you go on the ground, and he goes past. That's the scene. Shall we do it? Because they never rehearse these things. So, I mean, I couldn't see because I've got this great big helmet, you know, with a funny thing with a feather sticking up. And, of course, I rushed in and all the stuntmen are hitting me. The first one hit me straight away with this aluminium helmet that crushed. So I couldn't see out. I was just a bit. So I ran up the stairs. There was the arrow down. Boom. Out came Sir Lancelot. Whack. He knocked the sword out of my hand. And instead of missing me with the punch, he actually connected, and I got knocked over the battlement, and I fell about 8 feet onto all these sods of ground, you know, they keep for close-ups and all the rest of it. So I'm thumped out there. So Lancelot rushes around crying, and Hannah Weinstein, who was the producer, saw this and thought to herself, this guy's a stunt guy. And seeing a stuntman got £100 a week and I got 25, I ended up falling over every battlement, off horses. Anybody had to do anything dangerous, Charlie here did it. I didn't know it was any different. So, you know, I played a speaking stuntman.
You did things like William Tell and...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then, of course, you did everything.
Everything.
Invisible Man, Danger
Man.
Oh,
goodness,
yes. Saint, Doctor Who.
I know, I'd forgotten all about them.
Man in a Suitcase.
Someone said to me, you did something with Mervyn something or other. I'd totally forgotten most of these, absolutely.
Persuaders also, you
know. Yes, with Mr. Tony Curtis. Very funny.
Yeah, you bit of a toughie sometimes, weren't you, Darren?
Oh, yes, I know. I always tend to kill people and be very, very unpleasant, generally. so I'm stuck with that.
I suppose you're, in a way, Special Branch was rather special, excuse the pun, for you, wasn't it?
Yes,
really?
Because it was.
You played a really big leading part, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, I did. And there was a lot of funny things about that because I got dressed in... I did the... What was it called now? With McGowan, Prisoner. And the man who wrote it with him had written the episodes of Special Branch, and he asked me to do it then. And so I had a friend there who was one of the creators of Special Branch and one of the, you know, story editor. And so I decided to get dressed in proper clothes, really smart clothes, because I knew a guy from Special Branch and they're very smart. So I had all the nice clothes on and the scripts. If there was a woman in the show, I'd flirt with her, you know, arrest her and, you know, whatever. And I never saw the producer, the gentleman, a Canadian gentleman, and not my favorite man. Because, I mean, can you imagine doing a show and you never meet the producer? And after about the eighth episode, he came down to the restaurant. I didn't know who he was. And he said, "I'm closing the show down because why are you dressed the way you are? What is all these clothes and your
collars, wasn't it?
Collars and,
yes,
and sideburns, and what is all this thing flirting with the women, and why don't you ever arrest anybody?" Because I said to the story editor, "Why do we arrest everybody? Because they're brilliant for 53 minutes and then, you know, we've got to arrest them and they do something stupid." He said, "That's a good idea." So I hardly ever arrested anyone. And then one of the scenes was a load of Pakistanis leaving Dover, and I got the word through, "Why aren't you being excited?" I said, "I'm not interested in Pakistanis coming." I said, "You can't tell me that every policeman treats every case as a matter of life and death. I'm more interested in having my flat redecorated than the girl I'm going out with. I'm not interested in Pakistanis. I'll do my job. But, you know, allow me not to be interested like normal policemen. I'm not interested in everything." Anyway, so he closed the show down. And then I went to do a film in Berlin, and they put out the first episode, and I think it went to number 3. So he had to renegotiate. And I heard him say, "This is what I wanted. I wanted a policeman with big collars and and the sideburns. I wanted him a bit more sexy." He fired me for doing that. And then he did The Bill, because he never wanted anyone to be stars, you see. He just wanted actors to be sort of blobs, which... not my favorite man. I'm not sure whether he's alive or dead, really, but...
Inspector Jordan you were in that.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
Fulton MacKay, I think, was in that.
Fulton, yes, he was a lovely guy. We used to throw the scripts out of the window quite often, because we'd do a scene, and I'd say to him, "What do you think, Fulton?" And he says, "I don't understand what it's all about." I said, "I agree with you." So we threw it out. I mean, we were very popular. And then he'd say to me, "What... You know, because the directors weren't any good. I mean, all they wanted to do was make certain the camera was pointing generally in the right direction. And I'd say to him, "Fulton, I have not one idea what the scene is about." So we basically wrote them.
Put that light out!
I'm trying to relax and listen to John Hannum.
My current guest is Darren Nisbet, obviously a great TV star and movie star. We haven't talked about movies yet, some exciting movies to come. Let's talk about movies. In the early days, things like Silent Enemy and Room at the Top. And I think you were a bit of a thug in Room at the Top. Do you remember that fight on the towpath?
I do indeed. I tell you secretly, he was so drunk because he had nothing to do that night, and he used to like white wine. So he had nothing to do. And so... Oh, it was Bradford. It was a canal in Bradford. And it was late, 3 o'clock in the morning. And so he'd had about 3 or 4 bottles of wine. And he was swaying. Well, you can't hit or miss someone as if you've hit them if they're swaying. And I said to the director, I said, "He's swaying." He said, "I know." I said, "If he stands still, then I can look as if I've hit him, you know, not." So he said, "Well, just go for it anyway, and if you hit him, we'll get him out of the canal." We've done most of the scenes with him anyway.
Room at the Top was a big movie, wasn't it? Breakthrough movie.
Yes, it was. Yes, and Victim too was with
Dirk Bogarde,
and that was a big hit.
I suppose, in a nice way, everywhere you go, people say "Where Eagles Dare," don't they?
Oh well, yes, because it's being shown all the time, and I don't know. I've only ever seen it once at the premiere. I don't like watching
But you played Von Happen?
Yeah, they changed the name, if I remember
did
right.
They?
I don't know why they did that, and I had to sort of mouth another one. But But I mean, I got it all right. All the medals were actually right. So not that anyone will notice, except the fact they didn't wear black uniforms in 1942 and there weren't any helicopters. And I said this to the director. I said, by the way, I said, you know, this black uniform, oh, Darren, it's a beautiful uniform. I mean, really sexy. You know, the black, I mean, the women will go crazy at the black. I said, well, I'm sure, but I mean, they didn't wear these. No, they ended it in about 1939. He said, oh, yeah, they didn't wear it. I said, no, they didn't wear them. And we got helicopters, and they don't have helicopters. And he looked for a moment, he said, they'll never know in Arkansas.
Sort of a, you were a German, famous German.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Did you have a job to get over that German image or not?
Well, no, not really, because I did another one with Frank Sinatra. But people, you seem to think I've only done two Germans that I can think
of. You must have made a big impact.
I must have done, yes, yes.
How different was Burton at that stage to when you'd met him at the Old Vic?
About the same, but age had, you know,
taken its toll a bit.
Yeah, but Elizabeth Taylor was charming. She was a wonderful lady. She was so sweet and ordinary. You know, we all thought, oh my goodness, me meeting Elizabeth Taylor, you know, oh my goodness, you know, she's going to be really, you know, absolutely sweet, nice, lovely person.
And Clint Eastwood, of course.
Very quiet man.
Was he?
Very, yeah. Very quiet. You'd never notice he was in the room, even. The original script was a bit overwritten, and Clint Eastwood used to go up to Burton and say, Dickie, I don't think I need to take all these lines here. Do you want to carry some lines? And Burton said, yes, I'll say them. And, you know, Clint Eastwood sort of ended the film saying, yep, nope, up, yep, and stole the picture, really. It was marvellous, but always saying, do you want to carry? Yes, I'll say them.
What about that cable car scene as well?
Oh, yes, they left me up there.
Yes.
They left me up there. We did it. And
you're still there, are you?
Well, yes. I mean, it was swaying. And I thought, well, I'll come down in a minute. And, you know, everybody sort of went away. And one had to wave and say, you know, excuse me, it's getting a bit dicey up here. Yeah. No, it was great fun.
Such an impact, because everyone hated you being a German, didn't they?
I know. Yes, I've been loathed. I've been loathed.
Naked Runner, too, with Sinatra.
Oh, that was great. That was amazing, because he was such a gentleman. He was such a nice man. And we got on extremely well. I think primarily because it was sort of like the leading part with him. I think primarily because one of the tabloids offered me quite a lot of money to write my story about working with him, because in those days he was an icon. I mean, and I turned it down because I didn't think it was the right thing to do. And I think he heard about this. And so we became quite friendly, you know. I mean, I couldn't ever say Frank. I always said Mr. Sinatra. And he always used to say, come on, Darren, come for lunch. You know, we sit there and all these Hollywood men came around. But he did an amazing thing, because there's a story that was in a book about him, written by a woman called Kelly, about something that happened between Sinatra and myself. Not that she ever asked me if it was true or not, but it was. But she said to me, you ever been to Copenhagen? Because we're going to shoot in Copenhagen. I said, no, Mr. Sinatra, I've never been. He said, you'll love Copenhagen. People are lovely. Well, instead of shooting in Copenhagen, they shot my bit in Welland Garden City, which is what happens in films. And he said, oh, he said, look, he said, go to Copenhagen, have a holiday on me. So I had a rather big house in the country. So this huge Mercedes with all these doors, a bit garish, turns up. And I'd taken about £3,000 with me, because I didn't want to appear, you know. I didn't have any money, you know. So we get driven to Heathrow. There's his private jet. We get in the private jet. Made a terrible mistake. Listeners, if you ever get on a private jet, don't sit on the sofa, because you can't find the seat belts, and everyone will know that this is not your normal form of transport. As I didn't know where they were. So we arrive at Copenhagen, and there's another rather vulgar things, and a man in a grey suit comes out and hands me a thick manila envelope. Get in the car, drive off, and I count. It's all this money. And we're there for 10 days, and I said to my wife, who's now my ex-wife, thank God, I said, all this money, we'll never spend all this money in 10 days. We go to the hotel, and there's a suite with all the bedrooms and kitchens and lounges and goodness knows what else. And then we go out. We come back about 4 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock in the morning, there's a ring on the door. I can't find where the front door is. There's so many rooms. So I finally find the front room and I open the door and there's that same man that I met at the airport in the grey suit. He said, good morning. And I said, good morning. He said, I hope you had a lovely evening. I said, yes, thank you very much. And he handed me another manila envelope. It wasn't for 10 days. It was every day I got the same manila envelope with this vast, it was pocket money. You couldn't spend one of them in 10 days. And that story's in the book.
And it all came from Sinatra.
Oh, yes. And I said to him, it's very kind of you when I saw him again. He said, are you going to come and see me at the festival hall? And I said, yes, I am. I can't get seats. This is when I was doing Special Branch. He came back years later. He said, I hear you're doing a good show. I said, yes, Mr. Sinatra. I said, I can't get tickets. He said, I'll get you tickets, but you're going to have to pay because it's a charity. And he took everybody out to the Mirabelle beforehand and took over Claridge's in the evening. And I sat on his table at Claridge's. You know, he took the whole thing. It was an evening. It's quite remarkable.
Heidi, hi!
Howdy, ho!
Hello, listeners. You are listening to John Hannam Meets.
Currently, I'm at Eastbourne with Darren Nesbitt, who's touring Britain in Picture of Dorian Gray. Saw it last night.
Oh, yes.
Lovely play. Really enjoyed it.
Good, good.
Fascinating man you are. Monte Carlo or bus with Jack Hawkins?
Oh, yes, I remember that. So he just had the operation, you know, and he's had his throat removed, you know, the vocal cords, and which was sad, really, because, you know, a man with who was so well known for his amazing voice, you know, to have cancer of the throat and have it all removed was sad, very sad.
You've done some amazing movies. With Cain and Moore, didn't you,
Roger? Oh, yes, yes.
Did you do a couple with them?
No. One. Roger Moore, I've done quite a few because he was a friend of my family because he was married to, I can't remember who he was married to. He was married to a music hall singer. And, of course, I met him through my family. You know?
He was very close to Dorothy Squires.
The one I mean, yeah. Dorothy Squires, yeah. Whom, of course, was a friend of my family. Mm. And so I met him at that time. Yeah, nice man, this charming man.
And absolutely. Michael Caine, another sort of...
Oh, he's very, very nice. I never worked with him apart from that one film, which was a strange film. I mean, bits were no longer in it. We were at the premiere, and I was with another actor, and he tapped me on the shoulder, and he said, didn't we do a scene here? I said, yes, I think we did. He said, it's not in. I said, I know. He said, strange, because it was actually telling everybody what the film was about. I said, that's probably why nobody knows what the film is about.
I think that was that one called Bullseye?
Yeah, I think it was Bullseye, yeah. Yeah.
I know you certainly did Oh, You Are Awful with Dick Emery.
Oh, yes, I really liked that. I really enjoyed that one. He was such a nice man, such a nice man. I thought it was a very funny film.
It was almost sort of back to your roots in a way because he was sort of pure musical type variety.
That's right, that's right, yes. I enjoyed that very much.
When you look at the list you've worked with, Dirk Bogarde, we mentioned, Olivier you worked with.
Yes,
you?
Yes, Term of Trial. I know, it's amazing. I mean, being in Australia for so long, I was head of drama at a university, and then because I got married anyway, the marriage dissolved anyway, and so I thought I'd better do what I've always done and went to Sydney and got an agent, and the agent said, could I have your CV? I'd never done a CV. I couldn't remember what I'd done. So I did something. I did three plays there, Jeffrey Barnard, and I played the miser in The Miser. And the most amazing experience, Troilus and Cressida at the Opera House, directed by Michael Bogdanoff, a Welshman. Brilliant. But to be in Sydney at the Opera House during the Olympics was something that was quite remarkable, quite remarkable. And then I thought, well, I've done this now. I better come back.
Also, Stanley Baker, I must mention.
Stanley Baker.
Innocent Bystanders.
Yes, I remember that one. I was sort of like a stuntman again in that because I remember being shot, I think it wasn't, shooting off a table, going for a very, very long time and hitting a piece of wood that they've forgotten to move, which is a bit painful. But I remember that, yeah.
Just before we leave your movies, The Blue Max, which was another big movie.
Oh, yes, we destroyed the Air Force.
Were you Fabian in that, I think you played?
I think it was, yes. And that was another one that they cut the story out because they put so many flying sequences in, so the story didn't really happen in that film. But we destroyed the airplanes because they said to me, can you taxi an airplane? And I said, no, not really. Anyway, so the First World War planes. He says, oh, no, don't worry about it. It's because it was done in Ireland. We'll get a pilot. He'll teach you how to taxi. And so the pilot came in. He said, oh, hello, Darren. I'm going to teach you how to taxi. I said, why aren't you flying? He said, I had a small accident. I thought, oh, this is really good. So he taught me how to taxi. And there was this huge scene where George Peppard was being pulled out. I'm sitting in there and I taxi out. Another actor taxis out. Then the camera pans through and all the real pilots take off. Well, George Peppard was another drinker, you know, quite amazing. And again, he had nothing to drink that day. And there was this vast scene. So by the time we did it, his eyes were going in opposite directions in the plane. So they put the goggles on him. And then they said to me, go. And they pulled him out. And of course, I didn't give enough throttle. I didn't move. And it was pandemonium. Stop, cut, bring everybody back. 4 hours later, we did the scene again. George now was unconscious. And if you see the film, you'll see he's got a white scarf around his neck, which is tied to the plane to keep his head up. Because he was totally, because he had nothing to do. They just pulled him out. He was actually unconscious. So they thought, we better keep his head upright. Otherwise, people would think, why is he flying looking at his knees? So anyway, he gets pulled off. And I'm so terrified, I give it full throttle. And the pilot, the Irish pilot, said to me, he said, oh, Duran, he said, I must tell you something when you're taxiing. I said, what's that? He said, whatever you do, don't let the joystick touch your balls. I said, why? He said, because you'll take off. So I said, listen, there's no way the joystick is going to touch my balls, I promise you. So I gave it full throttle. And of course, you take off. So the joystick went kabang. And so I'm holding the joystick and I'm going up. And I'm thinking, my God, I've taken off. And I pushed the joystick with two hands down and I bounce back. So I've got to take my left hand. I'll never forget the throttle was right up there. So every time I lifted my hand to get it off this, the joystick went bang back into my balls. And so I'm bouncing up and down and I see a church. And I think, I'm going to die in a church. My father would never forgive me. So I kicked the rudder by sheer accident and turned round and the wing came off, which was great because there's no lift. So now I'm coming back towards the camera with this plane that's going full throttle. And I finally stop it. But the next actor, he saw me go out fast. So he did it and he kicked the rudder at the same time and went left and took all the propellers off the plane. So between us, we destroyed the Air Force. It was interesting.
You've written, you've directed,
yes,
you've
I
done
have.
Lots of things over the years.
Yes, I have. Yes. Great fun.
And you did more recent TV. You did some comic strip presents.
Yes, I did. I did. We did. I did quite a few of them for the fellas, you know, and that was a funny thing because they would just throw in any old thing and say, do you want to play a Welshman now? Because we haven't got someone to play the Welshman. Go on, do the Welshman for us, will you?
And West End seasons, Business of Murder, Run for Your Wife.
Yes, yes.
Did you enjoy that West End
show? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, I did a lawful. I mean, I'd done about 250 plays, I think. Yeah, because I started very young.
I
say to people, 3 years old. But
you did Emergency Ward 10, I'm sure.
Oh, I did. Yes. I did Emergency Ward 10, yes, when it was live all those years ago.
Is that scary, Darren?
Well, only because I was playing someone I'm lying there and I had nothing to do that day, you know, that episode, because I was under the operation. And I was sending up everybody, you know, and I was saying, you know, you'll never remember your lines and all the rest of it. And so just before the operation, and they do it very seriously, one of them had got a piece of ice in his hand. And he said, my stomach's bared. And he placed the ice and moved the ice across my stomach. It felt like he was cutting me, you know, because I thought, this idiot, he's really doing an operation. He thinks he's a bloody surgeon. And I couldn't move because I was supposed to be unconscious.
And voiceovers, you've done a few voiceovers.
Well, when I came back, a voiceover agent got in touch with me and said, oh, I've been a great fan. I'd love to do voiceovers with you. And I said, I've never done any. And she said, well, Doctor Who are doing one and they'd love you to do some voices on that. And I've got a corporate man in Hong Kong who wants you to do one because there's a bit of Shakespeare and all the rest of it. And that's all I've ever done. I haven't done any other than that.
But it could be good for you, couldn't it?
Well, I suppose so, but I never did any, you see. I never did any.
And you're glad to be back in England,
right? Oh, yes, absolutely. Yes, I got married again for a lady I've known for 20 years, and I didn't realise that marriage could be so happy.
Darren, it's a great thrill to come across you almost by accident, and I'm so glad I did.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm very glad you did. I'm very glad.
And I know you like meeting sort of everyday fans, don't you? It's part of your life.
Yes. I mean, you know, if they're kind enough to ask you to sign something, and or if they're kind enough to say something to you, I find that extraordinarily pleasing.
You've come an awful long way in a film called A Night to Remember. You didn't actually get a credit, but I think I read somewhere it said man holding oar on upturned lifeboat.
That's right. That was me. Yes, and it was November, and it was minus goodness knows what, and I was wearing this little vest, and they kept on throwing ice water over us to make it look realistic. And I thought to myself, if this is filming, I think I want to be a lawyer.
You've done all right since then.
Yes, a bit.
Lots of luck in the future.
That's nice of you, John.
It's great. He's got a swell personality. He meets and greets the stars with such amenity. Good enough to make you coming out of the street. John Hannamay. That's right.
You've been listening to John Hannah Meets, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.